Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. In November, Massachusetts voters will be asked to decide on four ballot questions. WBUR, the McCormick School at UMass Boston, and the Boston Globe are hosting a series of debates on each of them. Today, it's question one, whether to grant the State Gaming Commission authority to permit a second slot parlor.
This is a very common sense question on the ballot. I don't see how people can be opposed to bringing more revenue into the state.
The city of Revere has historically voted for gaming. There's a difference between legitimate gaming and a gaming proposal that lacks detail and doesn't really benefit the city.
We should be mindful of the fact that we don't exactly know what the consequences and the impact of all this is going to be when the dust settles. Let's wait and see what happens.
The debate over question one, next on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
From 90.9 WBUR, this is a special edition of Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Boston Globe political reporter Stephanie Ebert.
We're broadcasting live from the McCormick Theater on the campus of UMass Boston. It's our election ballot debate series, the third in our special broadcast debates on the four ballot questions that will be put before Massachusetts voters this November. And our series is hosted by WBUR, the McCormick Graduate School at UMass Boston, and the Boston Globe.
Today we'll hear the debate over question one, whether to expand gambling in Massachusetts by allowing the state to permit a second slots parlor.
And I know we'll have a great debate with our panelists here at UMass Boston. We'd also like everyone listening to get involved, and we'll tell you how to do that in just a moment. But first, allow me to introduce to you David W. Cash. He's dean of the John W. McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies, and he joins us to tell you a little bit more about these debates. Dean Cash, welcome, and thank you so much for hosting us.
Thank you, Meghna and Stephanie, for moderating this important debate on allowing an additional slots parlor in Massachusetts. Question one on the November 8th ballot. Good afternoon, and welcome to the third of four debates on the ballot questions facing Massachusetts voters this fall, broadcast live here at the John W. McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at UMass Boston, this capital city's public research university. The McCormick Graduate School, along with our co-hosts, WBUR and the Boston Globe, are delighted to welcome you. And also a special thanks to today's debaters, Dave Neely, a Bangor, Maine city councilor, and Celeste Ribeiro-Myers from the Committee for Responsible and Sustainable Economic Development. Ballot initiatives are one of the most direct way that voters get to set policy. About half the states in the U.S. offer ballot initiatives, and as is happening here, they spark civic discussions about issues that directly impact people's lives and their communities. Today's focus is on the expansion of gambling, a topic that has engaged voters, state lawmakers, governors, and communities in Massachusetts for over a decade. Expanding gaming facilities touches on many issues ranging from freedom of choice to addiction, to how a state raises revenue, to local and regional economic development, to crime, and to competition between states. I look forward to seeing how these issues will be discussed today. And now, I'll turn it over to Meghna and Stephanie.
Thank you again, Dean Cash. Well, as the dean so ably introduced, we will be discussing question one, a proposal to change the state's casino law to add a second slot parlor in the state. WBUR's Steve Brown has this explainer on question one.
The sound of casino gambling at Massachusetts' only operating casino, Plain Ridge Park Casino in Plainville. While larger, full resort casinos are being built in Everett and Springfield, and the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe is attempting to place a resort casino in southeastern Massachusetts, under existing law, Plain Ridge will remain the sole electronic gaming or slot parlor allowed in the state. But one developer wants to change that.
Good evening, Madam President and council members. My name is Eugene McCain. I'm a resident of Revere for the last year.
Eugene McCain is the person behind question one, which would authorize the Massachusetts Gaming Commission to award a second slot parlor license. McCain declines to speak with reporters, but last May, he outlined his plan for the Revere City Council.
But we thought there might be some openness among the citizens of Massachusetts to reinstate that second license to help the horse racing industry. And we thought, as an applicant in Revere, that we might have a good shot at getting that license awarded to a project here in Revere.
Question one is narrowly written and very specific. It would allow a slot parlor to be located on a parcel of land at least 4 acres in size and adjacent to and within 1,500 feet of a horse racing track. That's a description of land McCain says he has purchased or has options to buy land along Route 1A in Revere, not far from Suffolk Downs. While the land's proximity to the track is key, Suffolk Downs CEO Chip Tuttle says the track has nothing to do with McCain's proposed development, nor with efforts to pass the referendum.
At first, when it came to light, we had to sort of fend off accusations that it was us, you know, that we were somehow secretly trying to use this ballot question as a backdoor to gaming development here on the property. We made it very clear it wasn't us.
McCain's plan is to construct 2 hotels and a casino on the land, which now houses some auto repair businesses, a bar, and a rundown trailer park. He says a poll he had taken of Revere residents this past spring shows 64% support a casino. However, he's finding little support in City Hall.
The position for the city is that we are against it.
Revere Mayor Brian Arrigo has supported past gambling proposals, but says he has serious doubts about McCain's plan, which he calls fly-by-night.
We have some great potential in the city of Revere, and I want to make sure that folks know that we have a higher standard than a slot parlor, and what we're going to be able to bring to the city is a much higher and better use for that property.
Has the casino ship sailed in Revere?
Yes, I think it has.
State lawmakers once considered allowing 2 slot parlors, but they cut it back to 1 before approving the casino law back in 2011. One of the legislators instrumental in shaping the law was Senate President Stan Rosenberg. He's not taking a public position on the referendum, but says the current law is working just fine.
We now have 2 resort casinos that are under construction, and we have the third, the Mashpee Wampanoag, having received federal recognition and land in trust, are planning and preparing to construct theirs in southeastern Massachusetts. And the law said up to 3 casinos and up to 1 slot parlor, and it's right on track.
Rosenberg says the legislature relied on studies that showed the 3-in-1 limit would create a competitive gaming market that was not oversaturated. But the backers of Question 1 argue there is room for another slot parlor. Jason Osborne is with the Yes on 1 committee.
I think what we've seen so far with the Plain Ridge Park and the success that they've had in Massachusetts and contributing $88 million to the state, which is very much needed, I think, for the revenue here, and also, you know, the $18 million that's gone to horse racing. This is a very common sense question on the ballot. I don't see how people can be opposed to bringing more revenue into the state.
Should voters approve Question 1, there's no guarantee Eugene McCain's plan for a slot parlor in Revere would come to fruition. He would still need to persuade the Massachusetts Gaming Commission to grant him a license. The commission, which is remaining neutral on the referendum, could opt not to award the second slots license or possibly award it to a different group near another racetrack in the state.
That report from WBUR's Steve Brown. Well, let's get to the debate. We asked the 2 groups on either side of Question 1 to offer their chosen representative for today's debate. That's how we've been handling all the debates in this special series. And the group behind the ballot question, Yes on 1, is called Horse Racing Jobs and Education Committee. It's run by Revere's Eugene McCain. That group provided us with David Neely. He's a city councilor in Bangor, Maine, where he worked on an initiative to turn the Bangor Historic Track into the Hollywood Casino Bangor. David Neely, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. And I want to...
Well, hang on. I'm just going to introduce Celeste here for a second. And on the opposing side, we have Celeste Ribeiro Myers, the chair of the Committee for Responsible and Sustainable Economic Development. Celeste, welcome to you.
Now, before we begin, there are a few ground rules to go over. We're going to be breaking up this debate into 2 segments, economics and then social impacts. We'll spend 15 minutes on each of these topics. Participants will have 1 minute to respond to each question from Magna and myself, and 1 minute to rebut when necessary. Our colleagues sitting in the front row here will have will raise a green paper to mark 15 seconds left, and a red paper to mark when the 1 minute response time is up.
And David and Celeste will each have a 45-second closing statement at the end of the debate. So those are the ground rules for our debaters. And listeners, there are several ways you can participate in today's debate. We are broadcasting a Facebook live feed of today's event. You can go to facebook.com/Radio Boston to watch the feed and submit questions there. We're also taking questions as well via Twitter. Please use the hashtag MAballots. That's ballots with an S.
All right, let's get started. Our first topic is economics, and we will begin first with David Neely, Bangor City Councilor. David, as Steve Brown's piece covered, and as we mentioned in our introduction, Eugene McCain is the driving force behind this ballot question. He's the developer who's pushing it, who wants to build the slots parlor. So can you explain to us why you're speaking for this project here today? Why is he not here?
Yes, and I do feel a little bit like Marie Osmond, speaking on behalf of Nutrisystems or whatever the group is she speaks to, because quite frankly, I represent a city that had a tremendous success story with a very similar project. It's what I call a right-sized gaming and entertainment facility with a hotel. And that revenue stream for our particular city allowed us to rehab our waterfront, connect an entertainment quarter with a brand new civic center, with the gaming and hotel complex right through our downtown, enhancing economic activity all over the city, including 5 new hotels that were built since that was up and running, many new restaurants and many retail stores. And this was all done through this past recession.
So the ballot question as it's written would realistically only really apply to a plot of land that is owned by or that Mr. McCain has options to buy. So why should Massachusetts voters support a question that's tailored specifically for one man and one location next to Suffolk Downs but not associated with the racetrack?
Well, in regard to why they should, is they should because it'll lead to hundreds of new jobs and millions of dollars in new revenue for their city, which, by the way, based on my assessment in a short period of time, Revere desperately needs. This particular location is perhaps the best possible site in the city because, indeed, anybody who's driven by realizes that there's nobody that lives in that trailer park that chose that as their number one choice as to where to live. So I think there's certainly credence from an economic standpoint as to why they'd be fully supportive of this particular project at that particular parcel of property.
Celeste, would you like to respond to what David Neely said?
So in terms of the location, obviously that was one of the first things that caught our attention when the question arose, which is why we took it to the SJC. Their official position was that theoretically this could be applied any place across the state. And the reason why, if someone were to erect a track and then want to go ahead and submit an application, the reason why we've heard from folks across the state that have concerns about this question is that the Gaming Commission has shown time and time again in this region specifically how they have been able to apply broad latitude to the interpretation of legislation. So this could theoretically impact anyone across the state and additionally crack the door open for additional enhancements, changes, and tweaks to folks who are coming from far away, like Mr. Neely in Maine, Mr. McCain in Thailand, and his other advocate from Guinea. So we'd like to, you know, kind of nip that in the bud.
Well, let me ask you a follow-up to that, because Eugene McCain, the developer behind this question, he just earlier this month gave a question and answer session with the Revere Advocate, and he said that he's hoping to build a hotel and entertainment complex that would be part of the what he calls the renaissance of Revere. It could generate millions in annual city revenue that Revere could use for education, infrastructure, public safety. And then he also pointed to Plain Ridge, where the current slot parlor is, and he said that Plain Ridge added some 500 jobs with benefits, and 20% of those folks that Plain Ridge hired had been previously unemployed. And he anticipates similar numbers for Revere if this goes through. So why shouldn't Revere share in those new jobs and revenue?
Well, currently Plain Ridge is underperforming. I understand that Mr. McCain and his organization have used that as kind of the template, because the reality is, as discussed with Jason Osborne recently, that they only really have a concept, an idea that they're floating by Revere voters. And it seems like essentially they're leveraging an affinity for prior development proposals, and people just think it's, you know, one more time they're being asked the same question about casinos. But we really need to dig deeply at this and realize that there is no local, regional, or statewide support. In fact, the folks that they're purporting to want to enhance their industry and the quality of life, the horsemen, there are two horsemen agencies and entities in the state, neither of which are aligned with this movement. So the name is a misnomer, too. Hmm. So again, this is just kind of a hope and a concept and a theory that we would really be wise to avoid endorsing.
Well, David Neely, I'm going to ask you to follow up on that, but let me add some numbers here, because the state's current slot parlor at Plain Ridge Park has generated some $88 million for the state in tax revenue in its first year of operation. The state had originally projected some $105 million, and last month those the monthly numbers even went down as well. So we have a clip of tape here from Paul DeBoli. He's a professor in political science at LaSalle College in Newton, and he does focus on casino gambling and gambling and gaming issues. Let's listen.
We're sitting here looking at the revenue numbers for Plain Ridge Park Casino, and we saw when the numbers for the month of August were released, we saw it down 5.54%. And because there would be so much uncertainty in the gaming market anyhow, regarding the Regency license, regarding the Mashpee Wampanoag's ability to game on their reservation lands, etc., that I find it hard to believe that the Gaming Commission would even consider awarding a second Category 2 license.
So, David Neely, why should there be another slot parlor in Massachusetts if the existing one isn't even meeting current expectations?
Well, I'm rather shocked by the whole premise. In other words, they only contributed $88 million to the coffers versus $105 million. Please, shut them down. You know, seriously.
Not saying shut them down.
The jobs, no, but obviously.
But why add another is
yes,
the question.
Well, in fact, just as with coffee stands, be it Starbucks or Dunkin' Donuts or any other place, there are very few times that we will actually try and do market assessments and say, when should a mature market that's in a hyper-competitive market space be not allowed to continue to compete among their own industry peers? And I do understand why this indeed does happen, because there's also what we call state-sanctioned gaming. Now, the state of Massachusetts gave over a billion dollars to towns and communities all over Massachusetts based on gaming revenues, which is a composite of both Plain Ridge and casino gambling, as well as the state-sanctioned games.
Hmm. Celeste, do you want to respond?
I'd like a second to respond. So you use the term mature industry. This is not a mature industry. We have one facility in the Commonwealth so far, and in its maiden year, it's underperforming. One would assume that the Bangor industry, however, is mature, correct? And they should be performing at peak. However, they have seen revenue shortfalls with the advent of the Oxford Casino. And I have an article here that I can share with you. So it's interesting that he comes all the way down here to say that we should add more, even though the industry is new, is in its infancy, is unproven, and we have not had the opportunity to see other developments bear the fruit that they have promised us.
To the contrary, the gaming industry is a mature industry.
And
the fact that you're separating casino gaming from other games of chance, I can see where you may say that, but the models are in other states. In fact, there's a town in the desert that grew up with the economic benefits of the entertainment business that we refer to as gaming. Now, in the city of Bangor, there's nobody in the city of Bangor that would say, gee, what a shame that we brought in this development. To the contrary, they help fund nonprofits up there. They're a big employer. They're our number one property taxpayer now. Used to be General Electric, but they've downsized over the years, shipped jobs overseas. In fact, we had that happen all over our part of the state of Maine, where we lost 38,000 jobs in manufacturing, with a significant change in forestry, farming, and fishing. So thank God we moved forward and brought in what has been an economic renaissance to the city of Bangor.
So David, tell us a little more about that tax structure, because my understanding is that the casino in Bangor, after a second casino opened in Maine in 2012, came back seeking a tax break and saying that the supply of casinos had outstripped demand.
So doesn't that suggest that there's a limit to the market in any one state?
Well, it does suggest that sometimes people would like to have some wine with their cheese, and I say that, and pun is intended. They are a very lucrative operation. There are an awful lot of businesses that would be envious of even the casinos and gaming operations that only do fairly well. Moreover, let me just state that the real reason for property tax abatement, we were also confronted with by our number two property taxpayer, General Electric. There are a lot of corporations that have real estate investment trusts now, and they hire their attorneys to look at ways to save monies when there are downturns in the economy. And one of the things they look to do is to get abatements based on the real estate value and or enterprise value of their organization. So that's what the city worked with. We met them halfway. We had a great mediation on it. The city's very happy with it. The council was happy. And it continues to provide significant revenue streams for the city of Bangor.
Celeste, would you like to respond?
You know, he's described that it's been a great boon to the city of Bangor, even despite the impact of market saturation seemingly hit with the addition of the Oxford Casino. I'd like to hear a little bit more about the crime rates. It's been a huge boon for crime rates, with Bangor reporting more than double kind of a national average, particularly in the area of the casino. That's not something we're interested in bringing to the Boston area or the Commonwealth, for sure.
Yeah, well, first of all, Bangor is nowhere near double the national average in crime. I will share with you that bringing in the casino, bringing economic opportunity and jobs, does not increase crime. Let me tell you what did increase crime, and it happened at the same time, around the same time we brought the casino in. There were a lot of folks in town, I call them the do-gooders, that thought it was important to have a methadone clinic for folks that had heroin and other opiate addict problems. So we brought in some methadone clinics. Unfortunately, it became an industry, and folks were coming in from all over the state of Maine and even outside the state to find housing and cheap apartments in Bangor for the purpose of the fact that our Maine insurance, Maine Care, covered 83% of those folks that needed their methadone. Now, with that, and you can call the chief of police and ask him, with that came a lot of what we call the petty crime, the little robberies and even some burglaries, but we had an increase in theft.
So, David, just to wrap this up, let's just go back to the revenue that's coming in, because according to the reports from the Maine Gambling Control Board, in August, the casino brought in a little more than $4 million in revenue. But according to the Bangor Daily News, revenue at the casino has been declining for the past 2 years in a row, down 2% in 2015. So what would make a slot parlor and not a full casino in Revere any different?
Well, you know, we're still getting to the nexus of this, and that is because in all due respect, 2% one way or the other, we're not losing much sleep over in Bangor. But anyway, getting to the Revere issue and the issue of critical mass, and whether you do have, with tens of millions of people flying into Logan every year, with still 250, about a quarter of $1 billion, $250 million, leaving the state. I'm talking gaming revenues. It goes to Foxwood, Mohegan Sun, Turning Stone, et cetera, even to Vegas. Your number two destination or number three destination by air for vacation travelers. Number one's Florida. We understand that in Maine, too. Number two was Vegas. So you're still losing a lot of revenues. Exactly what that pie looks like on the corner where there's a Starbucks, a Dunkin' Donuts, and a Honeydew, I don't know. But I really trust natural market forces to do what needs to be done so that they can all be competitive and make money.
Well, let's dig into this a little bit more, speaking of market forces, because there are other views about competition when it comes to gambling in the Commonwealth. I mean, Revere is right next to Everett, which is very soon going to be the home of a $2 billion resort-style casino run by Wynn. We spoke with Father Richard McGowan. He's a professor of finance at Boston College, and he specializes in the business of gaming. And he's worried about what he sees as a soon-to-be saturated gambling market in New England. So let's listen.
Right now, both Rhode Island and Connecticut are going to expand their offering and aim at trying to keep people from their states to coming into Massachusetts. Clearly, when the Wynn casino opens up in Everett, that'll probably be the destination point in all of New England. So having a slot parlor anywhere near that, I just don't see where there would be much opportunity.
And actually, Celeste, I'm going to turn to you on this just to give you a chance, because I want to hear from both of you on this. I mean, how do you share those same concerns that Father McGowan has, that there's just no market opportunity for a slot parlor given all the regional competition that we've been discussing?
Well, I think the more facilities that you drop into the state, the more hands that are going to be outstretched to grab the market share. And just to circle back a little bit, you know, a perennial reason that developers and casino promoters have given time and again is to keep the money and the revenues going into Connecticut in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. I guess Mr. Neely, and as proxy for Mr. McCain, thinks that we should export it to Thailand instead. Jason Osborne.
Excuse me, can I say he's not from Thailand?
If she can,
have her,
if she can have her minutes, then you can respond.
If I can have my, he's been in Revere for the last year. Okay, and Mr. Osborne has cited the 15 million travelers that come into Logan on an annual basis as being their target. Now, last I checked, most of the folks that come into Massachusetts do their tourism, their business, their education, everything else. They're spending their money here. Again, we don't need another external entity coming in to siphon that out, whether it's Mr. McCain, whether it's Mr. Neely, whether it's the agency they recently engaged from Las Vegas.
David Neely, please respond.
Yeah, and I'm sorry about the outburst, but frankly, when it comes down to people, you know, my mother is still told that she's from away because she came from Scituate, Mass to Maine. And in Maine, you really have to be born there or you're from away. But no, seriously, getting back to this issue about the market space, what we will end up with for the project in Revere will be a right-sized project, and I can't emphasize that enough, because the city of Revere and the city council and city government was fully supportive of the same mega resort type of facility that you're talking about now in Everett. Now they've been introduced to a right-sized facility. And so maybe this one only employs 500 people and only guarantees $5 million a year in annual payments. But for some reason, I cannot see the rationale behind folks that are 100% behind a mega resort, but a right-sized facility for some reason they're being reluctant to embrace. Thank
well,
you.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a special debate about ballot question one, whether to further expand gaming in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. If the question passes, it would allow the State Gaming Commission to permit a second slot parlor here. Our debate panel today includes Bangor, Maine City Councilor David Neely. You just heard from him. He's representing the yes on one side, and representing the opposing side, Celeste Ribeiro Myers, the chair of the Committee for Responsible and Sustainable Economic Development. And we've got now a question from an audience member. So if Andrew King, a PhD student at the McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies, if you're here, if you could come to the microphone and please ask your question.
This morning, Governor Baker opposed question one, saying the consequences of the existing slots parlor and the two casinos under construction are not yet known. Let's wait and see what happens before raising the possibility of yet another facility in Massachusetts, Governor Baker said. Why isn't that good advice?
David Neely?
Yes, well, actually, we had past governors, current governors, a lot of people in political circles that said the same thing in the great state of Maine, and I will share with you that he's taking what I would consider to be a very safe position and a prudent position at this time. At the same token, and we have already discussed this, the state right now gives out over $1 billion a year in monies that it receives through state-sanctioned gaming, which includes the whole gambit, including scratch tickets, lottery, etc., and casino gaming. That's significant revenue for the towns and the communities in Massachusetts. It just seems to me that unless there are other enterprises and other opportunities for new jobs and new revenue streams, that one should remain open-minded on such an opportunity. Thank you.
Well, let's shift gears here for a moment and turn now to the question of social impacts about question one. There's some overlap, of course, between social and economic impacts. And just as a reminder, both of our panelists will have 1 minute to answer questions and also 1 minute for rebuttals when necessary. So, Celeste Ribeiro-Myers, I want to start with you. We've got some tape here from Marlene Warner, Executive Director of the Massachusetts Council for Compulsive Gambling. She told us that Massachusetts ranks in the middle of all states in terms of problem gambling, in the range of 10% of 10%. And she said that her group regularly coordinates with like groups in Connecticut, home to Foxwoods and Mohegan Sun, which have been in operation for decades, and here's what they've found. Let's listen.
The interesting thing is that they're not seeing anything terribly different than what we're seeing. What we do know from across the country is that there are places with a lot more access to gambling venues, and the numbers are about the same.
So my question to you, Celeste Ribeiro-Myers, is an increase in problem gambling is frequently cited as a major concern in expanding gaming in any state, but if Marlene Warner is saying that the numbers are staying relatively constant, why should we be worried?
Sure. So it seems that the numbers that are being reported are staying relatively constant. However, a lot of folks don't report until it reaches critical mass. A lot of folks with addiction in general are not self-reporting, and it's less of a palpable issue for a lot of folks than, say, a substance abuse or that kind of thing. But studies do show that gaming addiction goes up exponentially with proximity to casinos and gaming facilities. A story recently closer to home, somebody who didn't self-report and didn't have loved ones to self-report, was a gentleman in Revere who was on Social Security, $600 a month. With the tools that gaming facilities have, when you have those rewards cards, they are privy to all of your financial data. Knowing this about him, knowing that he owned a home, both of the Connecticut casinos advanced him $35,000 in loans that he was unable to pay. Unfortunately, this did not end well for him. They placed a lien on his home and both of the facilities, and he actually is no longer with us. You know, so that's one of the extreme tolls that are played out many times over.
I have a question for David. Last week, UMass Amherst released the results of a statewide study from 2013. As part of the gaming law that was passed in 2011, the state's required to look at gambling trends before and after the casinos open in Massachusetts. The study found this: about 30% of the state's population are non-gamblers, and 64% are recreational gamblers. The state has almost 90,000 problem gamblers. So let's listen to some tape from Rachel Volberg, the principal investigator on the Mass Gaming Commission's study on the social and economic impacts of gambling in Massachusetts, who spoke to BUR.
We found in Massachusetts that men are three times more likely to have a gambling problem than women. In terms of race and ethnicity, blacks or African Americans are four times more likely to have a gambling problem than someone who has a Caucasian ethnicity. And then we found that people who had low education, that is, who only had a high school diploma or less, were quite a few times more likely to have a gambling problem than people with a college degree.
So, David, can you address how would another gaming facility impact problem gambling in the state, especially for those groups that Professor Volberg mentioned?
Well, I think actually the prior speaker had a study that suggested that even with the increase in gaming opportunities, there's no more of an increase in gaming addiction. So the two sort of counterbalance each other, I think. But moreover, I do want to speak to the fact that there'll always be addictive behavior, regardless of what the addiction is. And certainly it's great that the entertainment and gaming industry has seen it incumbent upon them to set aside funds and to make sure, indeed, that there are folks that are able to help the gaming addicts. But I'll tell you, in the state-sanctioned form of gaming, including scratch tickets, tends to prey on the lowest economic strata, the lowest income strata. And I see this when I go to a local gas station and I see folks and they're buying a bunch of scratch tickets, etc. So it's good that the state's paying attention to that.
Well, let me follow up, David Neely, because we actually have a question here over Twitter from person who identifies themselves as Star, a Boston Star. Why displace people in Revere for a slot parlor? How is this being a good neighbor? And if I could just add to that, I mean, how do you intend to convince the town of Revere that this is the best option for them?
Well, you know, in all due respect, this person hasn't seen the parcel of property that's the subject property. Again, and I will repeat this, that anybody who goes and asks the individuals there that live there, is that your first choice of where to have your property, they would say no. In regard to the flowers that were alluded to before in a flower basket, they're actually plastic. It's probably one of the more rundown facilities there is or parcels of property there is in the city of Revere. In fact, Joanne McKenna, the counselor who is the ward counselor, is very hopeful that something happened there. And she even said it'd be great to have a brand new hotel there and to have the opportunity for these folks to be able to reside in something a little more palatable.
Celeste Myers?
I do have a rebuttal, and actually the reference to the flowers was in reference to our offline conversation, because I have had the recent opportunity to drive through the area, and it is a sad little trailer park, but it's loaded with people's homes, and one home had some Halloween decorations outside. You can tell some children lived there. There was some, you know, basic foot traffic and vehicle traffic, people coming to and from, and it likely isn't their first choice of a place to live, but it is where they live, and it is their home, and I do hope something good happens there. And, you know, you can put up a nice shiny facade, and you can put up some neon lights, and you can bring in a whole truckload of sexy people to fill your slot parlor, which they probably won't be there for long. However, the plight of these people doesn't go away. And you don't whitewash the plight of the people who live here or the economic impacts in the Commonwealth, in the city of Revere. There's a reason why people are not clamoring to you. There's a reason why the horsemen are not floating over to you folks and nobody's getting behind you, because you're promoting a concept, an idea. There's no substance. And I don't see that you'll ever get the support of the Regent or the Gaming Commission. So...
Well, actually, we have had support from horsemen. In fact, that press release just went out. We've also had support from the majority of citizens, two-thirds of the citizens in the city of Revere. As we all know, Revere fully supported the full mega resort casino just not too long ago. So I tend to differ with you on that point. Now, in regard to the peculiar way that the city council in Revere, or some on the city council of Revere, have behaved, I don't know about that. It's sort of squirrely. It's for others to speculate upon, not me. I do know usually elected officials, and they should be prudent, they tend to play it safe until they have everything dotted, all the T's crossed, et cetera.
David, just to bounce back to what you said about Councillor McKenna, she is apparently among one of those councillors who is against this specific project. There are a number of city officials who are going to be announcing a campaign against this tomorrow. There's going to be a referendum in Revere on October 18th. How do you intend to persuade the people of Revere that this is in their interests?
Well, like I say, based on our polling data, two-thirds are behind this. Even citizens I've talked to say that they believe, they didn't use my word squirrely, but they believe that something peculiar is up. It's been driven in part by the mayor, and this started early on with the mayor and his assistant. Bit by bit, he pulled in some of the other longtime serving councillors like Councillor Bob Haas, Councillor John Powers, and others. And so my feeling is there must be something that's going on or that they're talking about or considering, either a different development opportunity for that parcel, which they all know is the number one crime spot in Revere and needs to be cleaned up. Or perhaps there's something else going on. But again, it's not for me to speculate on what it is that they have going on. But certainly the citizens at large are supportive.
Well, Celeste Ribeiro-Myers, I'm going to give you a chance to respond to that. I'm going to dovetail on what Stephanie said, that there is going to be a referendum in Revere. The people of Revere will have their chance to have their say on this. So should that not be say enough in terms of how the state should look at question one?
You know, the big thing is that what's wrong with this question is that everybody has been trying to be able to rely on the legislation as it's written, whether you're a proponent, whether you're an opponent. We've been trying to rely on the consistency or some consistency in the legislation. And part of that is the mechanism that allows residents to weigh in. The danger of having this non-binding referendum is, again, what are they voting on? It's not, the prior votes haven't been on whether or not they specifically want a casino, but what it means for Revere and the residents and what the benefits would be. They're voting on a concept. That's very, very dangerous, because then that just leaves everything wide open. And what does that mean for the mechanism that's supposed to be the safety for folks in a host community?
Thank you. It is time for closing arguments. Each representative will now have 45 seconds for a closing argument. Based on a coin toss before the show, we'll hear first from Celeste Ribeiro-Myers, the chair of the Committee for Responsible and Sustainable Economic Development, representing the opponents of question one.
Great. First, I want to start with thanking you all for putting this together. I think it's very important that folks realize what the driving force is behind this. I want to thank Councillor Neely for coming all the way down here from Maine for telling us how great this is going to be for Massachusetts. The number one thing is that this is not an up or down question on casinos in the Commonwealth. They are coming, at least until repeal 2018 crops up, and we'll have plenty of fodder by then. This is about opportunists coming from across the globe. He's been visiting Revere for a year, but he's coming from across the globe, and he's getting all of his colleagues and resources together. None of them are from here. Even the folks that agreed to sign on initially to the petition are not from the region. And the reality is this industry is too new, it's unproven, and we really need to give them the opportunity to bear the fruit that they promised they would without adding to it.
Celeste Myers, thank you. And now David Neely, city councilor in Bangor, Maine, representing supporters of question one. Your closing thoughts.
Thank you very much, Megan, and thank you, Stephanie. Thank you to WBUR as well as the Boston Globe, and obviously to Dean Cash and the John McCormick Graduate School here at Boston University. I want to say that our First Amendment is still alive and well. We have freedom of speech here, freedom of press here, and we even had the right to petition our government with over 5,000 signatures that were gathered in the city of Revere, 4,800 qualified, with over 100,000 signatures gathered statewide to get this initiative on the ballot for October 18 in the city of Revere and November 8 statewide in Massachusetts. It will bring jobs and millions of dollars to the host community as well as millions of dollars to the state. Thank you.
Well, that is actually all the time we have today. Your timing's perfect, both of you. I'd like to thank both of our guests, David Neely, city councilor in Bangor, Maine. Thank you so very much. And Celeste Ribeiro-Myers, the chair of the Committee for Responsible and Sustainable Economic Development. Thank you to both of you. I'd also like to extend a very special thank you to our partners in this debate series at the Boston Globe, and to Stephanie Ebert, co-moderating today. Stephanie, thank you so much. Even more thank yous to UMass Boston, particularly Dean David Cash of the John W. McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies. Thank you to the Boston Globe as well, and thank you to our audience on air, online, and here at UMass Boston. Come back next week, because next Tuesday we will be debating the final in this series, and that's question four about legalizing marijuana in the state of Massachusetts. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Boston school leaders are embracing a series of recommendations to address racial bias at Boston Latin School. A report from the U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts concludes there's been a pattern of race-based discrimination at the city's prestigious exam school. WBUR's senior education reporter Tanya Mosley has the story.
Boston School Superintendent Tommy Chang says the district and Boston Latin are fully committed to implementing recommendations set forth in a report by U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz. The investigation found that Boston Latin failed to properly investigate students' complaints about racial incidents in the school. Last winter, Lori Smith Britton's 15-year-old daughter told her parents that a classmate had threatened to lynch her while holding an electric cord in his hand. He also called her a racial slur. Ortiz's investigation found that BLS mishandled the complaint, and that was a direct violation of the Civil Rights Act. Smith Britton is pleased by Ortiz's report.
The fact that she or they have determined that one of the incidents was in fact, a violation of civil rights is actually confirmation of what we pretty much always knew.
Ortiz's investigation also confirmed allegations of discrimination at Boston Latin, including a complaint that Black students faced tougher discipline and more suspensions than non-Black students for similar offenses. Boston NAACP President Michael Curry says the findings are vindication for parents and students who complained.
And that's the challenge with this work, is sometimes you have to wait on the truth to come out. And I think it's an opportunity. I think everybody should know that this is for every student in Boston public schools and for every student at Boston Latin that will benefit from a better school as a result of this.
And Curry says, as one of the premier schools in the Commonwealth, Boston Latin has the opportunity to be an example for other schools.
There should be a message to every school in the Commonwealth that you better get your act together before there is an investigation of this magnitude, because there's an opportunity to be proactive to address these issues.
The school department has accepted a series of recommendations by Ortiz to protect students. Under the new headmaster, Michael Contempassis, teachers will undergo diversity training, and he has said he will ensure all student voices are heard. Smith Britton's daughter still attends Boston Latin. Smith Britton says the findings and the work happening at the school is a step in the right direction.
I think the new administration that's in place is really taking this seriously. They seem to be genuinely concerned with making sure that there's a culture and climate of respect.
To ensure that happens, the school department must hire a non-discrimination officer to make certain that all cases involving racial harassment and discrimination are thoroughly investigated.
That's WBUR senior education reporter Tanya Mosley. Now that the celebration over the newest iPhone has finally died down, we can celebrate one of Apple's true achievements, making voicemail transcription mainstream. I mean, finally, we can skip the spam and the meandering messages because, if we're being honest, does anyone listen to voicemails anymore? In the age of Twitter and texting, isn't voicemail the least efficient way to send someone a message? Well, earlier this summer, we spoke with the Boston Globe's innovation columnist, Scott Kersner. He talked to the IBM inventor who started it all. But we started by talking about Scott's own voicemail gripes.
Well, I've been feeling guilty about it for a long time because either people are texting me to tell me that my smartphone's voicemail is full and they can't leave a message, or I dial into my own desk phone voicemail and there's like 36 messages to listen to and they're all irrelevant because I haven't listened to them promptly. So I just wanted to explore, do other people have that issue? And I ran into an entrepreneur, this woman, Zoe Berry, and she said, you know what? I've completely engineered voicemail out of my life. I don't listen to it. I've trained everybody just to use text and email with me.
And why? Why is she doing that?
Well, I think she's, you know, she's emblematic of, you know, time-pressed, kind of workaholic business people of 2016 who, I think this is an important point, they don't have secretaries or assistants, many of them. Uh-huh. So they're managing all their communications inflow. And frankly, the time of dialing into voicemail, listening to the rambly messages, hitting delete, trying to fast forward, trying to save, it's really time consuming. And frankly, a really terse text message says, hey, I would love to have coffee tomorrow at 10. Let's do it.
LOLO, smiley face, smiley face, right?
The emojis, too. If voicemail had emojis, I think it'd be good for another 100 years.
No, there's got to be, I'm feeling a demographic divide here. Like, if you're definitely 40 or under, I virtually everybody I know in that age group is saying, don't call me, just text me.
Yeah, I think there is a demographic divide, particularly if you look at the comments on my column online. It's a lot of Globe readers saying, who are these young whippersnappers who don't have time to listen to a voicemail? And how can you be in business without listening to voicemail? Well, voicemail's only been around since the mid-70s. It's not, you know, we're not talking about the death of handwritten letters, which I would say is maybe, you know, a sadder thing. And, I do think it's generational, particularly because younger people are gravitating to LinkedIn messages and Twitter messages and Skype and Slack and all these ways to sort of get a really quick instant response rather than having your question languish in my voicemail box for weeks.
Or months or years for that matter, right? Now, what I loved is that you actually spoke with the inventor of voicemail, Stephen Boies, and what did he have to say about this?
Well,
No one wants to live to out...
a key mistake, which is I should have looked up his phone number first and called him to see if he has voicemail and to see if he checks voicemail, but I was on a deadline. So actually, I sent him a Facebook message and a LinkedIn message, and he responded to the LinkedIn message, and okay, we got on the phone. And he's about 73 years old now, proud to have invented voicemail when he was at IBM, but kind of like the rest of us, he said, I think I have voicemail at home. No one good ever leaves messages there anymore. And, you know, I like texts, and I occasionally listen to voicemail on my iPhone. That's what he said.
Listen to voicemail on his iPhone. Yeah. Well, speaking of that, I mean, Apple and possibly others are going to be offering, what is it, automated voicemail transcription? Would that be just then be sent to you as a text?
Yeah, and, you know, Google Voice and other services have been doing this
for a while.
You can get an email or text of the voicemails. I think as the transcription gets better, it'll be more useful. But a lot of people I interviewed use it already today. And sometimes, yeah, you do have to decipher proper names or things that the automatic transcription doesn't get exactly right. But, you know, it makes the information much more glanceable. It's not the 2-minute rambly diatribe on your voicemail box.
I have to say, though, part of me, I mean, maybe it's because, you know, I'm a radio person. There is still that certain aspect of information that is passed through the voice.
Do you listen to your voicemails, though, every day?
Oh, my God. I knew you were going to ask me that.
I want to investigate this.
If
Meghna hasn't responded to your voicemail.
If my phone says it's from some very essential people that I need to know what's going on in their lives,
yeah,
then I will listen to the voicemail.
Yeah,
but
work voicemail, probably too many to plow through.
Ethically, I have to answer you accurately. No.
You don't even know how to dial in anymore.
I think my mailbox has been full for like 2 years.
Well, the interesting comment that an entrepreneur who has this company that sells messaging, cloud-based messaging systems, said to me is, yes, people like the quickness of text, but they sort of do miss the tone and facial expressions of in-person. So he's actually seeing a rise in video conferencing and people who want to collaborate and sort of have their coworkers' faces up on the screen and be able to kind of look up and have a face-to-face conversation so you can get that tone of voice and get that nuance that you don't get from a text message.
So video conferencing is the new voicemail. I love it.
It's the future.
Scott Kersner is innovation columnist for the Boston Globe. Scott, it's always great to have you. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
Well, that's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.